This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Agassiz is a familiar name in Cambridge and Boston. There's Agassiz Street, the Agassiz School, the Agassiz Museum of Comparative Zoology, and further afield, the Mount Agassiz in New Hampshire.
They're all named after one of the most beloved and controversial figures of 19th century Boston. Louis Agassiz was a brilliant scientist, one of the fathers of American scientific education, but he was also an intellectual enemy of Charles Darwin and a racist. Christoph Irmscher tells the story of this complicated man in the new book, Louis Agassiz, Creator of American Science. Christoph Irmscher joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here in the studio with us. The book is a wonderful read, and I was wondering if you might start with doing just that, reading a paragraph from the book that sort of describes why Louis Agassiz was so beloved.
I'd be happy to. The details of his fabulous life had become the stuff of legend. Popularizer of the Ice Age, climber of mountain peaks, dredger of the deep seas, describer of fossil fish and jellyfish, taxonomist of turtles, Agassiz had done it all. He had given America its greatest science museum at the time, and he founded on Penikese Island off the coast of Massachusetts the first serious summer school in natural history, actively welcoming women as participants. At Harvard, he assembled around him the best and brightest young men of his time, thus creating arguably the first American graduate school. Born in full view of the stately snow-clad mountains of Switzerland on the shores of Lac de Neuchâtel, where he had first taught science to schoolchildren, Agassiz was mentored by the great naturalists Georges Cuvier and Alexander von Humboldt. When he came to the United States in 1846, not even 40 years old, it seemed as if the new world had always been waiting for him.
That's Christoph Irmscher reading from his new book, Louis Agassiz, Creator of American Science. Christoph, it's such a compelling paragraph because it, in a nutshell, describes this man who was almost larger than life more than a century ago. But I'm wondering if you could tell us, what is it that initially drew him from Europe to the new world, as you write, to Cambridge and Harvard in particular?
Technically speaking, he had a grant from the King of Prussia that allowed him to travel to the New World. But his mind was so expansive that he was always looking for new challenges. In Europe, he'd gotten as far as he could. America beckoned, it seemed to him, a field of new discoveries to be made, a way of enlarging his sphere of influence. And at first, he had just come to stay for a few lectures, traveling around the country and so forth. But Bostonians conspired to offer him a professorship that was the stuff of dreams for him, and so he stayed.
It's so interesting because it's not every day that you read of a scientist who regularly makes the front pages of the New York Times during his or her lifetime. So can you tell us in particular, what are some of the scientific discoveries that made him such an important figure?
It's a complex question. The Ice Age is associated with Agassiz. Technically, he never discovered the Ice Age. Other people did. But he was adept at promoting it. Throughout his life, he would always take things that other people had been working on, and he would recognize the potential to turn it into something newsworthy, something that would, in fact, not just enlarge his reputation, but also the reputation of science as a whole. So he was an activist in the sense that science as an activity appealed to him. He went from geology, the Ice Age I mentioned, to paleontology, to zoology, to embryology, and offered in a sense the best descriptions anyone had ever done of jellyfish. That's one of the greatest accomplishments associated with his time in the United States, and he started a great work, two volumes on jellyfish, Contributions to the Natural History of America, two volumes on turtles. So he was a field worker in the sense that he would take people out into the field to catch, as he called it, nature in the act.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you're describing a man whose mind seems to range across disciplines. He doesn't really recognize the borders between biology and paleontology
exactly,
or whatever.
Yeah.
But you also write about how he brought a special intimacy, almost a sensuous relationship to the practice of science.
Yes. Touching things was very important. He would walk around Cambridge with specimens in his pockets, and the children in Cambridge knew that he would always carry things with him. He brought specimens to the classroom. There's a story that he liked to tell about himself, that once when his eyesight had failed because he had looked too much, he'd spent too much time observing, he would take a fossil specimen and lick it because his tongue was the only thing that was left to him apart from touch, and he wanted to feel it. He wanted to incorporate it into himself.
So fascinating. Now, what is it that Agassiz did in terms of America's stamp on science or science education?
His greatest contribution to American science is the Museum of Natural History, which he founded starting in 1859, which he made into a research center that was nationally and internationally recognized. America did not have institutions like that museum. He would attract smart, brilliant people to come and work with him, and founded really the first research institute of its kind. He had a seaside laboratory out in Nahant where he would take students into the water. So these are his contributions. They're institutional contributions in a sense. His original scientific work pretty much stopped when he came to the United States. He became an entrepreneur, somebody who would raise money, who would attract people to Cambridge.
So let's turn now to the other part of Agassiz's life, because he has a complicated legacy. I mean, here you are describing this man who has this indelible stamp on how science is done, even to this day. And yet, at the same time, I mean, he counted amongst his friends, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Yeah.
But this same man believed that the United States should only be for the white race. I mean, he was, at that time, a racist. What led to those beliefs?
There's very little interest in race before he came to the United States in his work. My thinking is that he adopted this racial thinking in a way to emphasize his public importance to America, because everyone had an opinion on race. The racial matters were supremely important. Agassiz wanted, again, to be the leader in this discussion.
It was PR?
It was PR, but there was also a deep-seated belief that there were biological differences between blacks and whites, and therefore they should remain distinct, separate.
Well, how did that make him? He was in Boston at the time, which was one of the hotbeds of abolition.
One of the most disturbing things about this, and when I started working on the chapter on race, is the degree to which his views on race were shared by precisely his friends, Emerson. I quote a conversation in the book after Agassiz had returned from Brazil, and he was going on about the dangers of racial mixing. Emerson, in his journal notes, praises Agassiz. He says he was a man full of facts, a man that we need for our time. When you look at Emerson's journals, you find remarks like this one about interracial relationships. When two shadows cross, darkness thickens. When two lights cross, the light glows. That's Emerson in his journals. Now, arguably, Emerson did more to redeem himself permanently than Agassiz ever did. And you could object, you know, to my argument just on those grounds. But the point I'm making is that Agassiz, as in many other parts of his activities, was, in a sense, an indicator of what was going on in American culture. He claimed he was an abolitionist. He claimed that he was against slavery. He claimed that his racial thinking was for the benefit of the future of the United States of America.
Things like commissioning photographs
of
Southern slaves.
Exactly. All of which is nonsense. But he is not an outlier in terms of his views. He's an outlier in that he used his public position to talk about race, to make himself relevant to the discussion. But if you look around and if you see who shared these views, who agreed with him, his opponent at a wonderful man at Harvard, Asa Gray, famous botanist, you look at his journals when he travels to Egypt, finally he talks about encountering dark-skinned Arabs, and he says in his journal, finally, someone I can like.
But Christoph, I'm sure this is one thing that's been perplexing me all day. Louis Agassiz was a great scientist.
Exactly.
He was a great evangelist of nature and all of its wonders to be discovered.
Yeah.
He had made his name around the world on that.
Yeah.
Why did he need to seek relevance in anything or for anything beyond his body of work?
He felt that this was his body of work. He felt that science had to be part of the common life of society, as he put it. Not something that takes place inside the halls of academe, but something that is of direct social relevance, what happens around you. And race, the future of the United States, depended on the discussion of race. It was impossible for him to be silent on it. Do I wish that he had been silent on it? Would it have been an easier book for me to write? Certainly. To some degree, the attraction of writing about him is that he is so hard to write about. Mm-hmm. That this is not a biography that can be written in the celebratory mode. It's something that always has to be calibrated, has to be thought about, and so forth. And I like that challenge.
Well, in the last minute or so that we have here, it's wonderful to have this conversation with you because, of course, Louis Agassiz left his stamp here, in the greater Boston area.
Absolutely.
Both positively, as we mentioned, with the Agassiz Museum of Comparative Zoology, and in a more negative way, you note in your book that the Agassiz School in Cambridge changed its name once a young student discovered about Agassiz's more racist aspects of his history.
Yeah.
But you also write very beautifully that here's a man whose story, in your words, is riven with contradictions.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been hearing some of them. He was a self-proclaimed advocate for abolition, but he believed in the racial inferiority of African Americans. He was a brilliant scientist that believed in science education, but also was intensely selfish in terms of taking credit for his own discoveries and not necessarily sharing it with who he worked with. He doesn't fit neatly into a box.
That's true.
In other words.
Yep.
And I wonder, after you finish writing this book, do you feel that maybe we are mistaken to try and put him into a box?
That's my feeling. And that's what I ended up thinking after working with him, on him, for almost a decade. I could not offer you a succinct description of him. I need a paragraph. The paragraph I read to summarize him. And that's part of the appeal. Some lives tell themselves beautifully, coherently. His does not.
Well, Christoph Irmscher is a professor of English at Indiana University and author of Louis Agassiz, Creator of American Science. He'll be speaking at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge tonight. Christoph Irmscher, such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And before we go today, a quick addition to our story about a missing road sign in last Saturday's bus crash on Soldiers Field Road. The Department of Conservation and Recreation sent us an email during our show to say its Parkway road signs comply with federal guidelines.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.